Storyworthy Media, the best in story-driven content.
This is Greg Copewhite, author of The Pink Marine. You're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finn.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we're coming to you from the Marine Base Camp Pendleton in San Diego County, California.
Now, that place is like a city in and of itself.
Yeah, it's absolutely gigantic. Last time we were in, my wife and I, I like saying that, we were driving down there, and we stop, and we're overlooking the ocean, and there's like a whole encampment, yeah. Like down, like with tents and stuff, like on a beach on the ocean, like they were practicing the tent stuff or something.
Yeah, that's what they call it, the tent stuff.
Yeah, that's the official
word.
And they call
word.
It practice, too.
Yeah, right.
That's what they say. You can tell I was never in the
Well, you know what I know is that if you do go into the Marines, you are either sent to Camp Pendleton or Parris Island, South Carolina. Those are the two bases.
Yeah, those are the biggest ones, right?
Yeah. And we're talking about the Marine Corps tonight because our guest, Greg Copewhite, brings forth the topic, the Pink Marine.
The Pink Marine.
And what does that mean, Hannes? When I say that, what do you think?
I'm instantly thinking various social changes and don't ask, don't tell and things like that.
You're absolutely right, because Greg wrote a book called The Pink Marine. You can find it at thepinkmarine.com, and it is exactly about that. How he joined the Marines sort of accidentally.
That seems tough to do.
Yeah, but it was like his best friend was going to join. So he thought, well, then I'll join, too.
Isn't that the plot of Stripes?
No, I haven't.
Bill Murray's going to join. And so he talks Harold Ramis into joining the army.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could sort of see how that happens. I mean, have you ever been talked into anything like that?
No.
Come on.
Joining a military service?
Well, no.
On a whim? No, I've never been talked into
Okay,
that.
But I mean, any kind of group. Like, for instance, my daughter is a brownie now, okay? She serves the country. You heard me.
Yeah.
She serves cookies all around the country.
All around the country.
No, but I would never have joined the brownies had it not been for my girlfriend, who happens to be the leader. And she's like, come on, Christine, it'll be fun. And so I joined.
Yeah, but that's different. You wanted to do it.
Okay,
I'm not a joiner. I'm a solitary man.
I wouldn't have joined if it wasn't for her.
Cue the song. Yes.
Okay, so really, you've never been.
I don't join groups. I don't. This is why stand-up comedy appealed to me, because it's you're kind of like part of a group, but really you're completely alone.
Yeah.
And as often as I could be lonely, I'm still more comfortable being alone than I am in like a group of people. That's why I've been in a play, right? You've been in a play. Everybody's been in a play in LA. It's like it makes me uncomfortable. There's so many people, so many moving parts and depending, and like, what if that guy doesn't come in and make his entrance?
Seriously.
What if he doesn't show up? Yeah.
That's the excitement of live theater, though. That's the whole thing about being in the moment and being present. And
I don't like being present
in
the moment.
Why do you do the plays?
I've only done a few, and I haven't done very many. I've done like one every 5 years, and I go, all right, this is not comfortable.
I had no idea you felt like that.
Yes. Yes, I do.
Huh.
Yes. No, I love being on a set for a commercial or a film or something. But that, I think, because it's finite, makes it more palatable to me. Like, I can be part of a group for a finite period of time.
Well, there is with a play as well. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Weeks and weeks and weeks.
Jesus, Hannes, I had no idea you were such a downer.
I'm not a downer. I'm just not a theater guy.
Okay, are you a Marine guy?
No, I am not a Marine. I'm not a joiner.
You're not a joiner.
I'd be the guy. And you know, I'd be there, and the sergeant would be yelling at me, and I would be thinking of smart-ass remarks, which I might not be stupid enough, might not be smart enough to not say. It would not be a good situation. I actually had a fear because I am so old.
How old are you?
I'm so old, I had to register for the draft when I was 18, because the draft still existed, and Vietnam had just ended, basically.
So war could you have been sent to?
Well, no war, but I still could have been drafted into an army that wasn't at war, technically.
I see.
By the way, do you know the United States has been at war for about 93% of its existence? No, wow. It's true.
I believe you.
Out of the 200 some years, like 200 of them. Yeah, we're in war.
I suppose most countries are, though.
No, they're not.
Really?
But if you're the biggest country in the world or trying to be, that tends to happen.
Let's talk about the Marines. Here's what I know about the boot camp. I was looking into this because, like you said, who could be talked into going into the Marines, especially when it's as intense as it is?
Yeah. Marines especially, I believe, are the toughest.
I believe that's true as well. Phase one of the Marines, the boot camp, right? It lasts approximately 4 weeks. And here is when discipline will begin to be instilled in recruits by disorienting them and effectively cutting them off from civilian habits and mindsets, as well as reinforcing the mental and physical standards needed to perform under stressful situations that will be simulated in subsequent phases and experienced in combat situations. In other words, they're going to yell at you. They're going to freak you out. They're going to make you do shit in the middle of the night. There's going to be sleep deprivation. There's going to be food deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll get you like, so you're nothing. So you're just down to nothing. I think it's like Scientology, actually.
Yeah.
No, but with
better food.
But better food, right. Yeah. And then they instill in you. So it says the purpose of the first phase is to not only to physically challenge you, but also to psychologically break you down.
See, now you must remember that I've always been ahead of my age. So when I was 12, I knew that's what they were trying to do.
Right.
So it's like I would never volunteer for that. I would never want to be broken down.
Right.
Although, frankly, it wouldn't have been a bad thing for me to be rebuilt. Mm. I could be like one of those houses that you buy and you rebuild it and put up a McMansion. A whole rebuild would have been a good thing. But my foundation, my slanted foundation is set.
Okay. So it says, this is again, phase one. At this point, civilian thoughts. It's first of all, just to think that you're not a civilian anymore.
Yeah.
Like you're not even, it's like a whole different subset of people.
Yeah.
Civilian thoughts and habits are considered detrimental to training. So they are squashed during this period by intense physical training, unchanging routines, strict discipline, and heavy instruction.
Yeah.
You would hate that.
Oh, I would. But I know I would hate it. That's why you aren't going to talk me into it.
All right. All right. Phase two of recruitment training.
By the way, did anybody see the glint in her eye? I was like, you would hate that. Because you want to be my Marine sergeant. That's what you want. You want to be. Boy.
What kind of time do you think I have? Honestly.
I think you want to put on the hat with the flat brim and black face.
Yeah.
Because they're always a black guy in the movies. It's Louis Gossett Jr.
Or with Richard Gere down on the pavement. And he's drooling, foaming at the mouth.
I got nowhere else to go. That's right, Richard Gere. You don't. But by the way, they made Love and Death. Remember 70s Woody Allen? He's in the Russian army. And the drill sergeant is black for no good reason. Oh, he's like, you love Russia, don't you, boy? Hilarious.
I got to turn this microphone down. Okay, so phase two of the recruitment training is an introduction to field skills. It includes 2 weeks of marksmanship training and a field week and a team week. So this might get more fun. Now, maybe they're playing laser tag. I'm not sure.
Yes, they're playing laser tag. That's how the Marines train.
No, but there's some weapons, there's targets. That might be kind of cool for a minute.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, people who like the Marines say that it's the best thing ever happened to them. But I think like when you hear stories of guys who were drafted like in World War II, I don't know if they were as... I don't know. I don't want to say rigorous, but it's like they needed bodies in World War II. They needed a lot of people, and they were getting civilians from all walks of life. People who normally would never have gone to the army, like in World War II, they went into the army. Bankers, you know, teachers, stuff like that. And so they had to like try and turn people who would never normally be in the military into soldiers, and that was a whole. That was the whole thing.
Well, I think Greg was in the 90s, I believe, or maybe in the 80s, in the 90s. Yeah. So we'll hear about that decade. But let's wrap it up with phase three of boot camp. Phase three is essentially the polishing of the recruits when their skills and their knowledge are honed and tested. So I guess it's like a combination of their physical strength, their mental capabilities, and their marksmanship.
I got to say that the movie Stripes so far has been right on. Everything in there is exactly what you've described, minus all the fun.
And it says it all ends with the Crucible. Is this right? The Crucible, it's the final test in recruitment training, and it represents the culmination of all the skills and the knowledge that a Marine should possess. Okay, so listen to this. It's a 54-hour field training, and it includes 48 miles of marching, and it stimulates typical combat situations, strenuous testing, hardship, and deprivation of food and sleep. What is happening?
This is like anti, you know, you know how there's a bizarro Superman who is the opposite of Superman? This is bizarro Hannes Finney.
Yeah.
No food. Yeah. Strenuous exercise.
No TV.
No TV. Everything that I would hate.
It's pretty exciting, though. I mean, you have to be very disciplined. So
well, no, I mean, if I had to go into combat, I'd want to have gone through it, and I'd want the people next to me to have gone through it.
I see.
Because they do, you know, you're sending them into something that you would never normally be. People are literally trying to kill you 24 hours a day.
Oh, my God.
If you're in a war zone. Oh, so that's a whole thing. Well, I kind of get it. It's like, and this may sound superficial, but it reminds me of, I'm thinking about football. Like, I love the Brett Favre.
I know you love the Brett Favre.
I probably don't ever want to meet Brett Favre because he's probably a hick and does a lot of stupid, like, you know. Pranks and stuff. And it's like, but I want him to be that so I can watch him on Sunday. But I don't want to hang out with him necessarily.
What are you talking about, man?
I'm saying you want the Army. Hey, I'm saying you need me on that mall. Well, you want me on the, I'm trying to quote, I'm saying we don't necessarily want to hang out with people who are gung-ho military, but we do need the people who are gung-ho military.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, I'm impressed by anybody who gets through this kind of training. And, you know, I was in the Peace Corps and we had nothing like this. The Peace Corps training.
What about the live fire? Because you remember you told me that they were firing live rounds at you while you're trying to make a pot.
No, we were all about the peace. Come on now.
Oh, right.
Well, anyway, I'm excited to hear Greg's story. The Pink Marine, thepinkmarine.com. You can also follow his blog. He has a great blog called Eat Greg Eat. Eat Greg Eat. When you put those letters beside one another, it looks like eatgregeat.com.
It's like anyway, Run Lola Run.
It's like that.
You're ordering him to eat.
Something like that. Because he's also a foodie, and you can find him on the show called Unique Sweets. Have you heard that?
Sweet.
He goes around and he tests desserts. Who gets that kind of job?
How do you go from the hardest job in the world being a Marine to the dessert taster?
Yeah, what is this? Wow, what
a guy. He's probably running around in some palatial, you know, like motor home, going from bakery to bakery.
Well, I'm anxious to hear from him. But before he comes on, I did want to mention that if you'd like to support Storyworthy, which, by the way, Hannes, we're heading into our sixth year.
Good Lord.
What do you think about that?
I think that's 10. It's not the 10th anniversary.
I don't know. It better be the green.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It needs to be.
Well, you know, some people are quitters and we're not those people.
That's
how many,
one way
how
to look
many
at
podcasts
it.
Have lasted 18 episodes and the 18 episodes were spaced over 4 years.
Really? I don't know. And people do that?
Yeah, people will just do it and then they just won't do it.
I understand what you're saying, but those, I don't even count those.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about the professionalism that is Storyworthy.
Here's what you can do, you guys. You can follow us over at Instagram at Storyworthy and, of course, on Twitter at Storyworthy. And why not buy my book, Pit to LAX, My Storyworthy Life?
Yes, the story of your basic training at Camp Pendleton. I'm trying to sell it to the people who are listening right now. You and Bill Murray and John Candy and Harold Ramis.
That's right.
At Camp Pendleton, you were fighting the commies. And it's fantastic.
All right, you guys, wherever you are, stick around because Greg Cope White is on his way here. Next time on Storyworthy, we have author Ivor Davis.
And I will be revealing all about being George Harrison's ghostwriter.
That's next time on Storyworthy.
Hey, it's Wendy McClendon Cubby, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
And we're back. We've left Camp Pendleton and the tents and the tent stuff, as they officially say. And we're now in Encinitas having a lovely brunch at the Encinitas Cafe.
There are so many places in Southern California that are just quaint and sweet. And you can literally leave L.A. and in 45 minutes be like, or like in San Clemente, or be down in Newport Beach.
Yeah, we
or
suddenly
Laguna.
Like Sherry, you know, arranged a whole bunch of like little like weekend things. So we've done a bunch of those in the past year, and every single place you go, okay, we can retire here. 3 months later, you go somewhere else. Oh, we can retire
it's
here.
It's an amazing amount of ridiculous. Small vacation spots. And Encinitas is one of those spots.
Yeah, it's very pretty.
All right, you guys. Greg Copewhite is here right now. He's an author, a television writer, a blogger, and he is a former sergeant in the U.S. Marine Corps. That's what we want to talk about. He also contributes to the Huffington Post and the Good Men Project. And his book, The Pink Marine, like we mentioned, is optioned right now for television. How about that? Wow. You can find Greg over at thepinkmarine.com and also follow his blog, eatgregeat.com. And find him on Twitter at EatGregEat. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Greg Copewhite.
You guys are great. That's a lot to talk about, just introduction. First off, shout out to all the Marines down in Camp Pendleton. You guys, I went to boot camp in Parris Island. Like you said, there's two. If you live on the west of the Mississippi, you go to Camp Pendleton. If you lived on the east, you go to Parris Island. And I joined in New Orleans on the other side of the river, the east side, so I got to go to Parris Island. You never know which one's worse. In Parris Island, they have sand fleas. Yeah. That's bad enough. And then in San Diego, they have something called Mount Motherfucker, which you have to climb a lot. And so during the training, a lot of boys bitch about that. And women now bitch about that. So, but I wanted to say that you guys, I know that you said that you mentioned not wanting to go in because you didn't ever think of yourself, Hannes, as a military guy. And first off, me too. I didn't ever think of myself. That's what's so surprising about my story. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book in such a funny voice is because, well, I'm a comedy writer, but also because I'd never planned. I never played Army. I didn't know what I was doing. I had no clue what the Marines were like. Had I known, I would have probably not ever signed up, but I'd never seen a video. I was raised by my mom was single at the time. And so when I was a kid doing that sort of thing. So I really didn't see those images. I didn't have a guy to look up to that told me. We didn't play Army together. And the whole idea of Vietnam just being over, you know, the military was a hard sell. We were still an all volunteer army. But when I was recruited, I sort of thought I was doing them a favor. So the book kicks off with the fact that I didn't pass the physical and didn't get in. I did lie on the enlistment contract about my homosexuality because it was just illegal. So I thought that was the big hurdle. But then to fail the physical and have to go through this crazy ordeal to pass the physical again. I cheated to pass the physical, by the way. It involved food. And you know, I was really, really fighting and thinking, how hard is it to get in this place? You guys need people. A war just ended. But it was so strange to me. So I'm going to read a little section. I just didn't know what I was getting into. So this is the first, when I first got there, I heard buzzing. We inched up a bit and I risked a glance out and to the left as I stepped up. Immediately, I felt a Marine rushing towards me. So I popped my head back into place before I had the chance for anybody to figure out what was happening. The line moved around a corner and one boy emerged from a room ahead. He had no hair. This was it, the legendary head shaving, and about to happen to me. In that video Sergeant Evans had played for me just after I signed my enlistment contract, I watched large groups of young men marching in unison. The camera zoomed down a line of boys outside a barbershop, then out to one kid sitting in a barber's chair, smiling into the camera. The barber grabbed the boy's head and roughly tilted it forward. He ran electric clippers over the boy's scalp, leaving nothing but the boy's sheepish grin. Within seconds, the brutal shearing was over and the boy sprang out of the chair, rubbing his bald head. Another boy hopped into the barber chair. To my relief, we moved on to another scene where the boys were now in camouflage uniforms, carrying rifles, and running through the woods up and over nets made of rope. I'd looked around to see if Sergeant Evans was nearby. I wanted to talk to him about what I was watching. I had a sinking feeling that this film was showing me what being in the Marine Corps was like. My success in convincing Sergeant Evans that I wasn't gay had felt like a victory. Meeting him, seeing the Marines on the posters, it all made me want to be one of those guys. To be one of those guys, however, I'd have to do what I saw in the video. At that moment, I'd started to realize that boot camp was going to be hard work. but I was still a ways from recognizing that I would technically be working harder than anyone else in my platoon. I'd have to do everything they did, but also mask my secret. Now the moment I'd seen in the video had arrived for me. I was not ready. The long hippie styles that had shocked conservatives in the 1960s had grown out comfortably by the 70s. Teen idols such as David Cassidy, Starsky, and Hutch had become my role models. I rocked huge feathered wings of hair that folded over my tiny egg head like the protective wings of a mother bird. This is how much I loved my hair. I actually believed that the repeat portion of lather, rinse, repeat was for the benefit of my hair, rather than the shampoo company's bottom line. My hair was already fantastic. I coaxed and cajoled it to new heights and widths with liberal application of product. My hair was my exercise program. By the time I finished blow drying my hair in the morning, I was exhausted. Both me and my hair needed time to settle down. I wanted to run my hands through it to say goodbye, but I dared not move. I got close enough to the door to see these three frumpy middle-aged civilian men presiding over their barber chairs. When they weren't shouting out for the next boy in line, they were discussing sports scores with each other like they were at a cookout. One of the barbers looked a little shaky, which didn't ease my anxiety. I'd probably get him. I returned to staring at the back of my best friend Dale's head as commanded. Although Dale's mother was Japanese, his father was Mississippi white. Spin Dale around and you'd be hard-pressed to pinpoint his heritage. He looked more Mexican, his Asian features blending into the multinational dimpled good looks of a United Nations staffer. But from behind, he could be the Japanese Elvis, with his pitch-black hair. Very shortly, you would not be able to mistake him for such a person. When I was living in New Orleans for 1 year in high school, I loved hanging out with Dale's family. They blended me into their activities. One night, I was maybe 15, and Dale's sister's boyfriend, Jerry, asked me if we wanted to go for a ride to catch a Mardi Gras parade. Thrilled to hang with an older teen, we jumped at the chance. It was an opportunity to show off our new home permanence, courtesy of Dale's mother. Yep, just a couple of white boys sitting in the den with towels around our shoulders while a nice lady took a long time reading the not-in-her-native-language instructions on the back of a Clairol box. The fumes obliterated any sense of caution over the idea of getting a perm in the first place. That evening, once our just-plain-wrong curls were dry, Jerry drove us around New Orleans, chasing the tail end of a parade. We got stuck in traffic. Jerry spotted some guys that he'd beaten in a fight the week before. Soon the toughs, appearing as Mardi Gras revelers to others, were taunting us to step out of the car and fight. The gang leader ordered one guy to bash in a headlight while another broke the car's antenna. I heard tapping on my window. I looked over, and my eyes met the barrel of the boss's gun. He twirled the business end of the pistol, indicating that I should roll the window down. I froze like I was trying to fool a bear into thinking I was dead. I finally managed to point at my head, hoping he'd understand the universal sign for mercy. Please, I just had a perm. Luckily, in a few seconds, enough space opened up for Jerry to drive onto the sidewalk and away to safety. My fond hair-related reveries were shattered when one of the barbers shouted, "Cover any moles on your head with your fingers and I'll mow around them." What? Dale turned back and our eyes bugged the same silent scream. We had no idea if we had any moles. The disgusting thought of growths on my head were overtaken by the mental image of blood spurting from the shaved-off bumps. Given the less than gentle treatment we were receiving, I had no confidence anyone would render aid. My turn came. The Marine at the door pointed to a chair before the current occupant had even finished. I got the shaky barber. Of course. I grabbed the chair's red velvet armrest for support and hesitated before twisting my body onto the seat. It was covered with the hair of other people. The barber placed his hand on my shoulder and pawed me into place. Any hope of a consulting chat with the kind-looking old man ended when he shoved my head forward into a humbling prayer position and bzzz. The cold steel clippers hit the nape of my neck, and he pushed the clippers across my head, ending with a flourish of my forehead. I wanted to look up at the mirror, but the barber held my head down firmly. The clippers tapped the back of my neck again, then another scrape across my head. The buzzing muffled when the clippers hit thick, intact hair, then resumed full volume as the hair fell away. I watched my prized hair fall to the ground and join the pile left by countless others. an accomplishment years in the making, became a memory in mere seconds. In the same few moments it took to buzz my hair from my head, the barber erased any doubt that I'd truly joined the Marines.
Yeah, that's intense, man. Your hair is so personal.
Oh, my God.
And yeah, it's part of you being, they're turning you into a machine. You're a cog. They all, everybody looks the same.
Which is what, you know, you talked about not wanting to be in a play, and you should be in a play with Marines because we're after one mission and we would all support you. You would get so much help on that stage. You know, they do have to, they also didn't tell me that I was going to wear only green clothes.
Yeah. No, so it's uniform. It's about unity, right?
They take away all of your civilian clothes.
I
packed five suitcases full of, it was 13 weeks. I'd never been away from home that long.
You were Private Benjamin.
The TV pitch does go out. Private Benjamin is Orange is the New Black meets Full Metal Jacket.
Is that right? The TV pitch for the Pink Marine.
That's the elevator pitch for the show.
That's really funny. What year are we talking about?
I went in 79. So Don't Ask Tell wasn't in place yet. It was just flat out illegal.
Wow.
And that was the big threat. And I also enlisted with my best friend. I think you could tell.
Okay. We joined in the buddy system. Two questions. One is, what was the impetus for you? Why did you decide to do this?
Total goof. We had just finished our freshman year of college, and my best friend called and he said, you know, I'm going to go off to join the Marines for the summer. I'm going to be in the reserves. I'm going to go to boot camp at Paris Island. His dad had been a Marine, so he wanted to make
it. So he had not been in college.
This is your half Japanese, half white friend.
And we're still best friends after all these years. He's a doctor.
Had been in college.
He had been in college. We both had finished our freshman year. He was going to finish boot camp in time just for the summer and then go in the reserves and be out in time for the fall semester.
And to go back to school.
Go back to school. And all I heard in that whole chat was summer and camp. And I thought, I love summer camp. And I love boots. So it was with that. It sounds insane, but it was with that level of thought about it that we went in. He argued, you don't know what you're doing, and you've never run a mile. We never, ever said, you really shouldn't go because you're gay.
Okay, so the idea of boot camp, though, is that you go for this period of time, and then when that period of time is over, you can go off into any number of careers, of course, with the Marines.
You choose. You bid on what you would like to do, and then at that last week of boot camp, they assign you what they've decided you're fit.
So I can sort of see where you were coming from. If you heard it was just for the summer, you know what I mean? And then you would have it under your belt. It'd be in your resume.
Marine Corps Light.
And we move on.
Yeah, exactly.
I can sort of understand that.
So when you you said you convinced the recruiter that you were not gay. Like, what was, you know, did he ask you specifically?
They asked you repeatedly, like you're being interrogated. He literally, back then they didn't call it gay, they called it homosexual, and they drew it out like homosexual. Yeah. So they wanted to really twist the knife and stab it. They asked me, are you a homosexual? And I said, no. And he said, have you ever practiced any homosexual activities? And I said, no. And he said, have you had any homosexual thoughts? And I looked at him and he was the studliest Marine with muscles bulging. And I thought, I'm having one right now. But I kept it locked up and signed that contract.
I've actually heard that any man that says he hasn't had a homosexual thought is a liar. How about that?
I'm thinking it right now.
Yeah. No, but
about,
right?
About, I mean, do I get a toaster? Our engineer looks like Aaron Rodgers. But no, yeah, no, but also.
you got a handsome engineer?
Yeah.
He's Ben probably. Stewart?
What, I'm sorry. Yes, thank you. Your handsome face made your name fly out of my head for a second. Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, first of all, what people think. It's so funny that they would say, do you have your thought? It's like people have thoughts all the time. People have murderous thoughts. That would never, you know, thinking things doesn't mean anything.
Right.
That took me a long time, but let's get back to me because it's not enough talking about me. But it's like my neuroses were like, I'm crazy. It's like, oh, you can think anything you want. That doesn't make you anything.
Right.
Including having the thought that you don't want to have a gay experience. And also getting to that point where you just mentioned about murder. You know, that's, Christine, you broke down those three sections of boot camp. The overall job is to train you to get over the fear and the basic instinct that we all are thankfully instilled with. And that's, we have to get over the fact that we won't kill. They have to convince us to murder on command.
Hmm. So. Wow. So in terms of stripping down everything you've been taught and then then they put that in. So what phase do they do that in? In the first
They have
phase?
To start at the very first day. They have to know, they let you know from all the speeches and all the lectures, you know, you are here to defend your country. You are here to fight. You are here to learn to kill. Yeah. That rifle range period, by the way, things, they're a little bit nicer for those 2 weeks. And it's not because they're afraid of being shot, because we are using live rounds. And of course, accidents have happened notoriously over the course of the Marine Corps and other military training systems. But they need to support you because they want you to be a really effective rifleman. I had only fired a 22 going in, and just once. So I had no skills. A lot of people come in pretty skilled marksmen. Maybe they've fired weapons at their family's farm or whatever, but I didn't have that. And so I had to really pay attention and learn. And after the 2 weeks, I still am a Marine Corps sharpshooter. So
really? So how many types of guns did you learn to shoot?
Two, the M16 and the 45.
Yeah. Pistol. Wow. Okay.
Do they still use the 45 or have they moved on to the Glock or all the more modern?
I don't know what
pistols.
They're using right now. And only officers fire pistols. So I don't know if you guys know, but after boot camp, it's kind of hair related. I ended up going to officer candidate school, which is boot camp all over again. And then I resigned my commission to finish my time in the enlisted Marines. And then I moved to New York to be an actor and a writer. But
oh, it all makes sense now.
Forgot about this. I did go to officer candidate school. I was at my regular Marine unit and my hair was a little bit longer because I was in a play in college. And I heard that my commanding officer was looking for me to order me to cut my hair. And I'd been hiding from him for days. And it was like Friday afternoon, 6 o'clock. And I thought I was getting away with it. It just barely a little bit longer. And the Marines have the strictest haircut. And so I see him coming down the hall and he has a pair of scissors in his hand and he catches me and he pins me against a wall and he's going to cut my hair. And I said, please, I need this for a play. And he said, are you in college? And I said, I am. And I'll cut it right after this. And he said, have you ever heard of officer candidate school? Would you like to go? And I asked him, would it make you not cut my hair? And he said it would. So I ended up signing up and it's boot camp all over again. But I love that experience. It gives you the perspective of learning to lead to Marines into battle.
How long does officer candidate school last?
It's 10 weeks. You can also split it over 2 summers, which I did because I wanted to go to Europe after one. And so I went to boot camp 3 times.
You're such an adventurous person.
Anybody out there, do it in 10 weeks. Don't split it up.
Really? Yeah. Even now you think?
Yes. Do it in 10 weeks.
Just get it over with.
Yes.
So do awesome. You, when you're in officer candidate school, is it more of the physical training like in boot camp?
It's a little bit different because they're actually letting us lead each other. It's called platoon leaders class. So the physical stuff is even more intense than enlisted boot camp, but we're all a little bit older, a couple years older, and everybody's in college or a college graduate to be there.
So do you have any tattoos, Marine tattoos?
I don't. Really? I'm a guy. I have a fear of commitment.
But I thought you have to. No, I thought you have to.
No, I never wanted to. I really never could decide. I'm not afraid of needles or, I mean, please, I've
but
had
the USMC
live weapons fired
thing.
At me. I could
but the, but the USMC, you know.
No, and now that I'm older, it would be all like, USMC.
That's not true. No, I don't think that's true.
No, I just never got a tattoo. I really
so how long in all, so from 1979 until when, would you say you were part of the Marine Corps?
1985. I was
really
6 years.
That's really exciting. Yeah.
So, and I did finish as a sergeant. And, you know, the Marines are the only branch of service where as long as your hair is in regulation shape, you can always wear the uniform.
That's so interesting because I have it written down here.
Wait,
I wrote that
you mean
about
even
your
if
hair.
You leave the Marines, you can wear the uniform
forever.
Huh.
Yeah. What is it about the hair and what do they say? Like it has to be shorter than a...
The Marines' what? Nickname is Jarhead because they, you know, have a lot of them wear a little short patch on their head because it looks like the guys can just reach up and twist it up.
So
like,
you can do the
me,
patch. You
yes.
can do a patch.
It's 3 inches at the regulated length, regulation length.
Three inches
at the top, evenly graduated to 0. So
3 inches is like a mohawk. What are you talking about?
Right.
3 inches off
Don't
your
you ever watch NCIS? Haven't you seen Jethro?
A Marine's hair could be that high?
It can be 3 inches.
Get out of here.
But it's not high. We're not spiking it up with mousse. It's just...
I see.
And most do get a crew cut.
I see.
Yeah, but that's the max it could be.
So do you still have your uniform?
I don't. My part of the story of the book is how much I moved around as a kid. I went to 13 schools in 11 years, and we moved around so much, I don't really have any... memory or history of a specific home. There's no sentimental things. And that also kind of
see now that's stuff. See right there. So that just to me says why this had some appeal to you as well. It did some create structure. A home and structure for you.
It absolutely did. I found that that's a great point. I really did find not just the camaraderie and the guys, but an organization that I get to call a friend for
life.
Did
you resent the fact that you had to hide your true nature?
I did not resent it because at that time, you know, our society was still out, was not in. Society was still telling me that my basic human nature was wrong. So I ran around with a lot of shame and a lot of worry, wondering where was my place in the masculine world. I didn't feel like I looked masculine. I didn't feel like I sounded masculine. Why in the world I jumped into the hyper-masculine world of the Marine Corps, I don't know. But I had a fabulous time.
No, I think you explained it.
And I was bullied as a kid. I was hassled as a kid.
I think the hyper-masculinity was part of it. You were like, I'm going to go whole hog into super masculineness.
You had nothing to lose.
And I wanted the best. I am gay, and the gay's like an upgrade. I didn't go to the Army or the Air Force.
You went all the way to the top. So did you know any other guys that were gay in the military at the time you were?
Yes.
Did you just wink across the way, or how did you?
No, it's a really sweet story with a sad ending as a result of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And that is part of a next section of stories that I'm putting for the next book together. That's about officer candidate school. Mm. But there is a greater freedom now that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is over to be out. But it's never what's discussed. We are at work. That's my job. Mm-hmm. And I'm not there to talk about my sexuality. I was there to serve my country and to do my job and be an effective Marine. You didn't come here today to work thinking I'm here and able to do my job because I'm straight. You came here thinking I'm here to be able to do my job and I'm going to do a great job because I'm talented and I can do it. Mm-hmm. So the Marines in general were my Marine compatriots were very supportive of my Marine skills. We did not need to discuss who I was sleeping with.
Good. That always struck me as odd.
It's like, why are you, ask.
But nonetheless, when you're in boot camp, did you all of a sudden look around and you're thinking like, well, I'm clearly the only gay guy here. Or did you look around and think like, hey, I bet you this guy or that guy's gay too.
I always felt that I was the only gay person. And I also didn't want to find out or ask anybody because that would reveal my secret.
Yeah.
We have talked about in the TV show, we've talked about having another gay person in the platoon and neither one of us know that the other one's gay. So,
oh, that's funny. That'd be good.
Did you ever see Biloxi Blues?
I did. Matthew Broderick did a great job.
Yeah. No, there's just a subplot in there of one of the characters is gay, which just shows up like later on.
I totally forgot about that. I'd love to rewatch that.
So you grew up Mormon?
Yes, I grew up Mormon and I had already left the Mormon church. But, you know, I left the Mormon church because, and I do eviscerate the Mormon church in this book as they should be eviscerated because they're a false religion. But I had left them because I didn't agree as a kid. I would watch them force tithe very poor families. And I thought that was not cool.
So basically make poor families give them money.
10% of their salary.
10%.
Every family, rich families, poor families, everybody. They're thrilled when the Marriotts have to pony up. Mm-hmm. But
let me ask you.
Trash Scientology.
Interesting. Your mother was married 5 times. And was she a Mormon? Can that happen?
She was recruited and with her second marriage, she was recruited. And then I was then baptized when I was 8. So I was 6 or 4 when she remarried.
Okay, so you weren't born Mormon. You became
Mormon. I was baptized Mormon. And by the time I was 10, I knew that it was a false religion. And so I observed. We were dragged to church every Sunday.
And Sunday, when you would go, it was like 6 hours long, right?
It's a whole day. You know, they make the families fast.
Marines are sounding awesome after all this.
Well, it plays a funny chapter. There's a really funny chapter. And of course, the Mormonism is a through line for the book, but there's a funny chapter because if you did want to get away from my unit, they did offer, they say, if you have any freak religions, like if you're a Jew or a Mormon or Buddhist, you can go to a special church. And I was like, I'm a freak. I'll go to the Mormon church. I'd left the Mormon church a long time ago. My decision to out the Mormon church for being a religion that practices hatred was then validated when they spent, I think, $100 million of their parishioners' tithing money to defeat Prop 8. And now you can get married. So there was a waste of that money.
So that was a complete waste of Yeah, Tom. Yeah, I remember hearing that. That was like a big thing.
Yeah, so not cool.
So then your mom, after her second marriage, then she wasn't a Mormon anymore, or?
She also left. She went back to, and you'll see it in the book, she married at 16 and didn't have children until she was 20, and then she had four children, so she never got to go to college as a young person. So she went back when we were growing up. I was sort of a latchkey kid. That's where I learned to cook. Yeah. That's why I can cook, from being a latchkey kid. And so she got her bachelor's and her master's. And then the best school to get her doctorate was Brigham Young University. And then she, once she was there and living in that environment of Mormons, she was like, whoa, this is really some bullshit. And so she left the Mormon church as well.
But wait a minute. Wait, if you say I'll go to Brigham Young for any circumstance at all, any kind of schooling, you know what you're in for. I mean,
you certainly do. And you don't have to be a Mormon to go. But once she got there, the politics, this was the late 70s, the politics around women's rights and women's lib, they wanted to put a kettle on that, put a lid on that boiling kettle. And she protested that. And she's like, look, I'm a woman.
Yeah, so she went through Mormonism twice.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she went through it twice. Yeah.
And she left.
So now what would she say that she is?
That she's a proud mother of a guy that wrote The Pink Marine.
All right.
Hey, you got some really great blurbs for your book, The Pink Marine, including one from our friend Jim Beaver.
I love Jim Beaver.
The Pink Marine is a wonderful book, and I'm proud to be Greg White's fellow jarhead. I didn't know Jim was a Marine.
Jim served in Vietnam in combat.
Whoa, what am I thinking? Why didn't I know that?
Jim's the shit.
Mm. Jim is.
He was on our show. I just didn't realize that. Okay, Margaret Cho says, Greg is as inspirational as he is hilarious. I love this book.
I've known Margaret for almost 30 years. I've worked with her for a long time, and I love her. She is a fantastic...
She's supposed to do our show in May.
Oh,
so
great.
Hopefully she will. She was supposed to do it in January, and now we're to May. So hopefully that will happen. How about this? This is the story of how, through pure gumption, a most unlikely Marine candidate rises to the occasion to show his true colors. Jane Lynch. How about that?
I love Jane. How amazing was she? I've never had anybody respond to emails and things as fast.
Normally,
is
so
the
nice.
Second fastest.
Now, do you know her personally at all, or was this strictly through? Okay.
Yes.
You know.
A little bit.
And Norman Lear wrote the beginning of your book.
He is amazing. You know, he was the he was my first writing job in Hollywood. How about that?
Which was on which show?
I wrote on Powers That Be. With John Forsythe and Holland Taylor and David Hyde Pierce.
Yes,
I remember that show. I remember that's the show that I remember watching and thinking that guy looks like Frasier's brother. And then a couple of years later, he was
playing Frasier's
brother.
When our show got canceled, the casting director sent a tape of David over. Yeah. And David blurred for the book, by the way.
Oh, how nice is that?
I love David. Norman was the perfect person to write the foreword. I'm incredibly blessed and honored. He is not only a World War II combat veteran himself, but as you guys all know, he's a legendary LGBT rights supporter, founding many, many organizations. He's got his own People for the American Way. His new book, Even This I Get to Experience, just dropped last year.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing book.
And he must be, what is his, he's late
80s now? He's 93. I really hope one of these careers works out for him.
Yeah.
But he's also a friend. And so that helped him.
That's really exciting. He lives here in LA, right?
He does.
Yeah, that's really exciting. When I think of Norman Lear, I just think All in the Family.
I know. And I was watching on one of my nostalgia channels, watching All in the Family. And I mean, people say this all the time, but it's so true. It would never get on the air now.
No.
And you know, he had to fight for those episodes then. He had to fight for the gay character. He had to fight for the abortion on Maude.
Yeah.
He went tooth and nail and fought for that. And he has a new show coming out on Netflix. They haven't started. It's not all cast yet. Rita Moreno's cast, but it's Latina One Day at a Time.
Wow.
Oh, I did read about that. Okay.
That's really fun. Why not? You know, why not? So let me hear about you and the cooking. I think I get the cooking thing in that, like, I like to paint and I like to do art and I like to play guitar. But
this is for her way of saying she cannot cook.
I can't cook. But my point is I do understand the beginning of something. I understand the middle and I understand the completion. And since in Hollywood, we don't really ever see that picture, because even if you get on a show, it gets canceled.
Yeah.
When you do art or you cook, there is a beginning, middle, and end. What do you think about that?
I think you want to know how I went from serving in the Marine Corps to serving pie on Food Network.
Okay, yeah.
It is what you just said. It's the beginning, the middle, and the end. It's all about writing. That's a story. Every story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Every recipe has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yes.
A recipe is storytelling, especially storytelling, we get to share a family's recipes. You know, when you're in the kitchen at a holiday event and you're cooking Aunt Martha's dressing, whatever, you're also telling stories about Aunt Martha.
I never had that.
And you're keeping her alive.
I never had stories about recipes.
Are you doing it with your daughter?
No, not really. Well, maybe with baking.
That's not true, because every baking, because you make Christmas cookies every year.
Yeah.
And you're telling a story and you're teaching your daughter to tell stories, and she, you don't know, but she perhaps could tell those stories to someone, and 200 years from now, your cookies are being talked about.
I hope they don't say fuck too much. You know what I mean?
It may be the fucking cookies.
Well, no. At that point, that won't mean anything. But the story will be like, every 10 minutes, my mom would have to run to the kitchen and smoke a doobie and pretend that the smell was going out the window.
That's what we call them. Doobie.
The doobies. Yeah.
That's what we call them. Exactly.
I'll tell you that writing has always been the through line. It's everything. Starting the blog, going from television writing to starting the blog, and Food Network found my blog, and I shot a pilot for them. And then while we're working on that, they've put me on Unique Sweets. So yes, it is an awesome job to run around and eat desserts.
Unique Sweets is on what network?
It's on Cooking Channel, which is Food Network's sister. Yeah, we shot at Beaux-Noirs down the street here.
If you haven't had it,
fabulous. Fabulous. Fabulous.
Do you ever eat things that aren't good?
If I'm not good on camera, I eat too much of something doing 100 takes. I had to eat like 40 churros a couple of months ago, and I was like getting a little sick from that. No, someone has scouted it. Our producer, Irene Wong, invented the term food porn. So she knows her food, and she has already scouted these places out and really done it. So no, I have no food allergies or food dislike, so I'll eat anything.
But the show, Unique Sweets, the food is always good. So that's not the reveal. The reveal is how they put it together or the presentation.
Yeah, how they make it and then our opinions of it. They ask the talking heads to come on and tell you, you know, if it's gooey and sticky and crunchy and if it reminded you of hot sex that you had in the back of a Chevy.
I see.
Crunchy sex in a Chevy.
Hey, man, you want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
I do want to play Shotgun Storyworthy.
That music can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the Storyworthy Wheel of Truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
The wheel landed on virginity. Okay. This is in the book. This story is in the book. I was in high school. I was a junior. I graduated after my junior year. There was a guy, Jeff Davis. I loved him. He was a great guy. Funny, sexy, amazing. And he would come to school every day exhausted. And I was like, dude, why are you so tired? And he's like, my girlfriend, it takes her so long to come. I fuck her all night long and I'm exhausted because we're like 16 and I'm like, wow, you must, you know, be exhausted. So I'm so sorry you're having to work that hard because you're so hot. And we graduated high school that night and somehow I ended up in a three-way with his girlfriend and this other girl, Joe Linda. And I'd never had sex with a woman before. And so I'm just giving it to his girlfriend. And about 30 seconds in, she pulls me by the ears and screams into my ear, do you mind if I come? And I was like, yes, because Jeff is fucking it up. And I thought, that poor Jeff is such a bad lovemaker. And I nailed his girlfriend and got her off in a minute.
Wow, that was the best story ever.
That's amazing. And so Jeff is in the room just watching?
Jeff was not there.
Oh, okay. Wait, now, yeah, so that's what confused me. So Jeff's not there at all. It's his girlfriend and her friend.
And a friend of hers, yes. We all knew each other and we're all like, let's just have a three-way. They were so excited that I was a virgin. Wow. That they said, let's show this guy a
good time.
That's
the first time that sentence has ever been uttered. Girls were excited. I was a virgin.
I heard there's a bunch of women that seek out virgins. I just read that online somewhere.
I could sort of see that.
Girls, don't come seeking me out because I'm totally ruined.
Yeah, it's all over now. Yeah.
I had a three-way for my first time.
Was that your first and last time with a woman or?
It was.
So you've never been with a woman since
then. How could I top that?
If you weren't gay, you would have to go like, I can't be with another. Yeah, it's never going to happen like that
really
again.
Good.
Exactly.
That's hilarious.
I'd rather go out on a high note. You know?
I'm speechless.
I've never heard the phrase, do you mind if I come? Like, I'm going to be like, how dare you?
I'm from the South. That's we're extremely
very polite.
Yeah, we're very polite people.
I love it. I think it's kind of
I'd be
hot
on the Marine battlefield, you know. Excuse me, enemy, do you mind if I kill you? Just see it a little still.
Hey, let me ask you something. I just wrote it down here. I was, you know, listening to you on some other shows. And what's up with bisexuality? Is that a thing?
Well, you brought up yes, Hannes, you brought it up by saying people think about everything. Why aren't we allowed to just do whatever we feel as long as we're not hurting someone? I think that I know from speaking to my female friends that if they date a guy who has been with a guy, they're never going to trust him not to want guys again.
Mm.
That's what I think. But I know many women that practice bisexuality. Most of the guys that I know that started out bisexual, that's the French word.
That's one of the bakeries you go to, the bisexual.
Wait, or what? Say that again.
I think most of the men that I know that have started out bisexual do cross on over to the full gay side.
Yeah, I find that too.
Well, we have that awesome parade.
Well, it seems like men, even now, I don't know. It's just sad that anybody would have to still question, but it seems like it's like taking them off the cliff a little bit or jumping off the cliff. So first they say, well, I'm bisexual. You know, they take it in smaller steps, as it were.
I think that's a good point. They do take it in smaller steps, and they're you know, we're so afraid of what others are going to think about us, what our parents are going to think about us, what our friends are going to think about us. We live in a society now, a time in our society where it's safer to be yourself.
Well, but we're in Los Angeles, especially I am, right? You know, I don't really leave Los Angeles very frequently anymore. And so I am in a different world of tolerance than most of the country.
Well, it's important. I'm sorry to cut you off.
No.
It's important that we're in Los Angeles and that we use our voice from this place of comfort and security to broadcast that we live an open and celebrated lifestyle.
Yes.
And I'm going home after this, and I'm not going to get beaten up on my way. I mean, someone can try, but I'm a Marine, so I wouldn't do it.
Yes.
But I live in a very safe environment. There are young people all across this country that are not safe.
And, I know.
And they need to feel that way. So we need to spread that love across the toast.
But what you just made me think of is it's also a generational thing, because I work with a lot of people who are younger than me and younger than everybody at this table. And it's not even, they're not, like, they have gay friends, they know gay people, they don't think about it. A 25-year-old does not think about it the way a 50-year-old thinks about it. Like, a 50-year-old pats himself on the back, like, I am not bigoted at all against the gays. But the 25-year-old is like, yeah, my cousin's gay, or this guy's, you know, it's right. They're not even thinking about it. And we're going to die off, and then someday they'll be like one 90-year-old guy who's like, is that guy gay? And they'll be like, you know, grandpa, you can't change him.
I hope you're right, but I don't know about that in middle America.
I think it's more, I mean, I think there's some tough.
It's definitely
to hope,
true in my daughter's school.
But I think there's a certain, even in middle America, I would think that that's true. Not 100%, but it's a lot more than I would think. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
I think we'll get there. I really think we'll get there too. You know, one of the reasons that Mormons hate gays is that, you know, Mormonism, just like recruiting to a military, is it's a hard sell, and Mormons need to make more Mormons to support Mormons. So they don't like gays because they're like, well, you're not going to give us any tithe payers. So
it's the same as Catholicism and birth control and all of that.
Yeah, they need some more. They
absolutely
want to raise those rates.
Hey, listen, you are a bright light, Greg Cope White.
Thank you, Christine.
We need you in this world. All right, you guys, you can find Greg over at thepinkmarine.com and on Twitter at @EatGregEat. And again, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. And I have a lot of fun, more fun with food on my Instagram, @EatGregEat.
Oh, course. Good. Oh, I love Instagram.
Yeah, I do too.
You?
I love it.
Hannes, do you use the Instagram?
I use Instagram all the time.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I get weird. I think it's weird. Like, I take pictures of their building Harry Potter at Universal. Every time I put a picture of that up, people go out of their minds.
Do you hashtag it Harry Potter?
No.
Well, that would help.
No. I'm saying people like just
they find it anyway.
They find it. They respond to the image. They don't even need to see.
I had to come up with an image. I wanted to write a thing about how I walked the dog to the donut shop, and I never felt more American. I was like, well, if I'm going to put it on Instagram, I have to have a image to go with my little joke. So I took a picture of the yum yum donut bag. People went nuts for that. It's completely.
You never know. You never know. All right, you guys, we got to wrap it up right now. I want to thank everybody at Sideshow Network, including people that aren't even here.
Well, they're here in spirit.
Like Sean Merrick and Roddy Swearingen.
Sean,
he's
Roddy,
not here.
Thank you.
But you know who is here? Ben Stewart.
Ben Stewart,
thank you so much.
I apologize
making
for
us
forgetting
sound
your name
so good
momentarily.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our storyteller today, Greg Cope White, and of course, John Thomas Griffith. You know, he wrote the theme song, Follow Me.
I've heard this somewhere. I don't recall exactly.
And on behalf of you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week. You can follow me, follow me. I'll take you down to the river. Follow me, follow me. I'll keep you.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.